nanohub.org.
You can follow along with this presentation using printed slides from the NanoHub. Visit www.nanohub.org and download the PDF file containing the slides for this presentation. Enjoy the show.
So, to continue what we were discussing last day, remember, that's the time-independent Schrodinger equation, and we're talking about how one could find the energy levels of a hydrogen atom. And the potential that you use here, that's this potential that an electron feels due to the nucleus. So if you have a positive nucleus here, then if you had Z protons, then the energy, that nuclear potential U of R would have been equal to minus ZQ squared over 4 pi epsilon 0 r. And for hydrogen, of course, Z is 1. Okay. So that's the potential you'd have in there. And as we discussed, the problem of trying to solve this equation directly in Cartesian coordinates is that it's not separable, in the sense that r is really square root of x square plus y square plus z square. What that means is you cannot separate it into a function of x plus a function of y plus a function of z. If you could do that, then this would separate out nicely into three 1D problems, and you could solve each one. We have discussed how it's fairly straightforward to solve the Schrodinger equation in 1D. You just turn it into a matrix and then ask MATLAB for the eigenvalues and the eigenvectors. Now, in this case, in Cartesian coordinates, you cannot separate it. But the point is, in spherical coordinates, you can. Yes?
Do we ignore the potential to start the electron in that case? Because you're just only saying that, okay, that is the potential due to the nucleus. But what about the electrons?
Right. That's what I'll be talking more about right after this. So at this time, if you are talking of the hydrogen atom, of course, what makes the hydrogen atom particularly simple is there is only one electron. So you do not have to worry about the potential due to the other electrons. Right? So for hydrogen atom, this is exact. As soon as you go to anything bigger than a hydrogen atom, like a helium atom, you have to worry about issues like that. And so that's what I'll be talking a little more about that shortly. Right. Okay. Now, what we discussed last day is that because all atoms have this potential which is independent of theta and phi, what it means is that the solutions to this equation can be written as a radial part and an angular part. They separate out nicely. And the angular part is a standard thing that you don't have to solve. You can just look it up. These are called the spherical harmonics. Okay. And last day we discussed the form of these functions, but that's something you can easily look up. And the important thing to remember in this context is that this entire set of spherical harmonics are indexed with two numbers, two integers, L and M. And the L runs from, like, integers 0, 1, 2, etc., while the M runs from minus L, again, integers only, up to plus L. That's the important thing to remember in this context. And if you wanted a particular one, like say Y2 minus 1, you could easily look it up, what function that looks like. Okay? Now, so that's the angular part. And then in order to find the radial part, that's where you have to actually solve this equation. And this is just looks just like a 1D Schrodinger equation. You see, it's not x, but it's r. It's the radial coordinate. But the equation itself, you see, looks like e times the function you're looking for, minus h bar square over 2m d2 dr2. So you could turn this into a matrix in exactly the same way we discussed for the one-dimensional Schrodinger equation. So this will become this tridiagonal matrix. When you put it on a lattice, this would become a tridiagonal matrix. You'd have stuff on the diagonal, something on the upper diagonal, something on the lower diagonal. Whereas this and this will just be diagonal matrices, because these are like any other potential. This is the potential due to the nucleus, and this is the additional potential that comes in whenever L is not equal to 0. For L equals 0, this is 0. You don't have to worry about it. But if L equals 1, there's this additional potential in there. L equals 2, it's bigger, etc. Okay? Now, so this is an equation that you can then solve. And if you put L equals 0, let's say, and you solve this, you'll get a whole set of eigenvalues. So you'd get something down here, something like this, etc. You'll get a set of eigenvalues. And these you could, you'd call 1, 2, 3, 4, etc. And because L equals 0, again, for historical reasons, these L equals 0 solutions are also called the S states. So this is labeled 1S, 2S, 3S, 4S, etc. So numerically, if you're solving for these, you'd go and solve this equation with L equals 0. Just drop that, solve it, okay? Now, this I didn't assign as a homework problem, but I think one of the problems in the book actually asks you to solve something like this, which I didn't assign. But as you know, at the back of the book, there are all the MATLAB codes that go with it. So if you're really interested, you could look at that code and see how it's solved. You could try this out, actually. But the point is, if you solve that, you'd get the known levels of the hydrogen atom. Like in a hydrogen atom, as you know, this 1s level, this lowest level, it is supposed to be equal to this quantity, E0, which if you put in the numbers, it comes to how much, you know? This lowest level in the hydrogen atom relative to is this minus 13.6 eV. 13.6 is what you'd get if you put in all those things, right? And these results that I had mentioned one day, even before Schrodinger wrote down his equation, of course, this basic result, this is kind of comes from the Bohr model. So people knew that these are kind of like the right answers for the energy levels, actually. And Schrodinger's, of course, great achievement was he wrote down an equation from which all this just came out naturally, see, without having to postulate anything. But I think one day I mentioned how if you postulated that the wave had to fit around a circle, you could get all the right answers, actually, for the hydrogen atom. That's the Bohr model. Anyway, so if you put all that in, you'd get this minus 13.6 eV for the lowest one. The next one would be how much? How would you go from? You have to, these levels go as this E0 over N square. So N equals 1, that was 13.6. N equals 2 means this divided by 4. Right? So 3 point whatever. So you'll get minus 13.6 divided by 4 eV. Next one would be minus 13.6 divided by 9, divided by 16, etc. Right? And of course, experimentally, what was measured and what was well known of was these differences, because the light that is emitted from a gas of hydrogen atoms corresponds to these differences. That's what was experimentally measured. Okay. So numerically, when you are trying to solve it, then the way you would go about it is you go to the Schrodinger equation, put L equals 0, and you get this whole set. Now, the thing is, you could then put L equals 1, and now you have a new Schrodinger equation to solve. Why? Because the potential has changed. Okay? So, you could then go again and solve it one more time for L equals 1. Now, the question is, would that give me energies that would be bigger or lower? It would be higher. And the reason is that you see, this potential is negative. negative representing the fact that the positive nucleus is pulling the electrons in. That's this negative that we talked about. Whereas this one is a positive term that's adding on to it. So what the effect of this term is to kind of raise all the levels up. Okay. And so when you solve for L equals 1 levels, you'll usually get things that are higher up here. And here again, of course, this way you might think that I should label them 1, 2, 3. But again, for historical reasons, this one, you start with 2. There is no 1. And L equals 1 levels are called the P levels. Again, historical reasons. So the lowest one is labeled 2P, and then 3P, and then 4P, and so on. Those would be the levels. So numerically, if you're doing it, you go solve the same Schrodinger equation with an additional potential. You find a whole set of levels, and those would be these. Now, in the hydrogen atom, as it turns out, this and this happen to have exactly the same energy. But that's not necessary. That's not necessary in the sense, if you go to any other atom, actually 2p will have a higher energy than 2s. 3p will have a higher energy than 3s in any other atom. Hydrogen atom is the only example where actually those two happen to be exactly the same. Those three, these are exactly the same. Okay. So it's this 13.6 over 4 happens to be the same. Oh, why is it the same? Right. I don't know of a simple reason for this. Why? I can state the answer, and that is that they come out the same only for this Coulomb potential. That is, a potential that goes down as 1 over r. If this 1 over r, instead of being, had been just a little bit different from 1 over r, then those two would not have been exactly the same. But it's hard to judge from here because what we can say is that because of that positive term, this series has to be higher than this series. That's clear. But what we are talking about here is the second one of this series, comparing it to the first one of that. And that's not obvious that how they would land up. Right? What is obvious is because you have added this positive thing, as a whole, this should be higher than that. The lowest of this should be higher, should be lower than the lowest of that. Similarly, the next one should be higher. That you can say. What's hard to tell is why these two happen to be exactly the same. And that is really a consequence of this Coulomb potential. Anything other than 1 over r, it won't work. And as I'll explain, for anything other than the hydrogen atom, the effective potential is actually not 1 over r, but is something else. The reason is that, you see, for the hydrogen atom, the only potential involved is this nuclear potential, as someone asked. Whereas, if you go to any higher atoms, bigger atoms, then you have to worry about the potential that an electron sees due to all the other electrons. And since all the other electrons are kind of distributed, the effective potential it sees is no longer just 1 over r. It's a more complicated function of r. And once that's true, 2s and 2p are not equal anymore. And 3s and 3p are not, and so on. Okay. Same, it goes on to the next one, which is the L equals 2 levels. And there again, as a whole, because with L equals 2, this term is bigger, I expect all the levels to be somewhat higher up here, somewhat higher up there, etc. And these are again historically called the D levels. And when labeling them, you start with 3D. The lowest one is called 3D. Instead of, you know, again, logically you might have, in this way you might have thought I should call it 1D. But again, historically the way it evolved, this is known as, this is 3D, that's 4D, and so on. But numerically, if I'm solving it, put in L equals 2, the lowest level you get here should match. And again, for the hydrogen atom, 3S, 3P, 3D all happen to have the same energy. Not for any other atom. Okay. Now, one important point to note is that this 2p level here, How do I calculate it? Well, I've put in L equals 1, and I get one eigenvalue there. But you'll notice that when L is equal to 1, there are three possible values of M. Because, you see, when L was equal to 0, M could only be 0. But when L is equal to 1, it will be minus 1, 0, and plus 1. So they got three levels. And so, although I have calculated only one level, there's really three of them there, in the sense that all three of them have exactly the same radial function. If you look at the radial part, it's the same for all three. But each one of them has a different angular dependence. One of them will be y1, 0. Another one will be y1, 1. Another will be y1, minus 1. And those are three different functions in theta and phi. You know, one is a cosine theta, the other is a sine theta, and so on. These are different functions. But they all have exactly the same radial function. So as far as the radial solution is concerned, it's the same solution. You just tag on different angular functions to it. Anyway, so the bottom line is that there's actually three levels there. All these P levels always come in threes. And same here, this one actually comes in threes. This is actually coming in threes. And those three are really on top of each other. You know, I've kind of separated them out so you can see three of them. But I should really be drawing them right on top of each other. Now, the D levels, how many does each one correspond to?
Five.
Because when L is equal to 2, I can go minus 2, minus 1, 0, plus 1, plus 2. I got five possible angular functions that I can tag on. And so each one of these now is actually five levels. Etc. Okay? Now, just to add one more thing to this that you should remember is, of course, overall, all levels come in pairs because of the upspin and the downspin, the part we haven't talked about much at all so far. And later in the course, at some point, we'll talk a little more about it. But this, in the beginning also, I mentioned that usually all levels come in pairs, which is why if you had one level, the maximum conductance would have been Q squared over H. But even with the smallest things, the maximum people measure is like 2 Q squared over H. That 2 is the 2 spins. And so this really is like two levels there. This is really 2. And that 3 really is 6. Because each one of those 3 has an upspin and a downspin to go with it. There's an upspin function and a downspin function. And same here, these 5s are really 10s because of this spin when you include that in. Okay? That's the thing to remember. And one of the big successes of this was that once people had, you know, once from Schrodinger equation, you kind of saw this set of levels, it looked clear. People could understand this periodic table of elements. Because, you know, again, that was something that was known empirically from before, that you could arrange the elements in this periodic table. And as you know, the way the modern understanding is that in any atom, of course, you have energy levels like this. And if you consider the hydrogen atom, that's the simplest one, that has a one electron in here. Now, when you go to helium, that's the next one. So this is as you are increasing the atomic number. This is Z equals 1. This is Z equals 2. So helium has these two protons in there. And the neutral helium atom has two electrons also. And so the second one then, you say, can go in there. Again, strictly speaking, I shouldn't be drawing two things in there because what the exclusion principle says is that every level can hold only one electron. So strictly speaking, I should be drawing two lines and putting one cross on each. Okay? Just for convenience, I'm kind of not cluttering it up with two, instead just drawing one and saying that you can put two in there. That's what often people do. They just draw one spin level, but they put two in there. Okay, so that's hydrogen. That's helium. Now you go to the next one, which is Z equals 3. And that one, I believe, is lithium. Now you see the third electron cannot go in here anymore. It has to go somewhere there. And so you first go in there. So then you fill up these 2s and 2p levels. And how many do you have there? Well, there's 2 that can go in there and 6 that can go in here. So you have a total of 8 electrons that you could put at this stage. And so the second row of this periodic table, you're basically filling out 2s and 2p one by one. And you go from z equals 3 all the way up to z equals 10. That's the periodic table. And then you go to the next one, which would then be z equals 11. And I believe that one is sodium, right? Okay, sodium. So that's the sodium one. So now the 2s are done. So they have filled up 2 plus 6. So that's 10 done. Now you're going to the 11th one. And that's when you put in the 3s. Okay? And so then you go down this row all the way up to 3p, which is 11, 12, all the way up to z equals 18. And then at z equals 19, you're ready to go on to 4s. Now, that's where something a little complicated happens. And after this, the story gets a little more messy. Because what happens is that you think that, well, you know, what happened to the 3D? There's 10 of them there. Now, as it happens, 3D is actually a little higher than 4S. So you first fill up the 4S, which means you fill up 2 of them, z equals 20, 2 of them. And then you spend 10 elements filling up these 3Ds. So you fill up all 10 of them. And then you start over again with the 4P. And these are again called the transition metals while you're filling up the 3Ds, little by little, you see. So the story gets a little more complicated up here. So 19, 20, and then 21 to 30 are all the transition metals. And then 31, again, you start with the 4Ps, etc. Okay. Anyway, so one of the great successes once people understood the scheme of things that, again, came out naturally almost from a Schrodinger equation was to understand this periodic table that was known from before. It gave a natural explanation for why it came in, you know, why it was 2 and then 8 and then 8, etc. That all came out naturally, you see. Now, one important point that I want to stress, and this is kind of what relates back to this charging effect that we had talked about before, that when we were discussing the simple model for nano devices, we had a parameter called U0, which is the single electron charging energy. And I kind of want to connect back to that and explain the issue that a very important point to remember is that, you know, the way I wrote it, it is as if you just solve this Schrodinger equation, you could find out the levels for every element, the way I said it. But that's not exactly true. As I said, it's only the hydrogen atom that comes out correctly. Everything else requires some additional, approximate theory. And that is because when you have more electrons, when you have more than one electron, you have to worry about what this electron feels due to all the other ones. Okay. And you can see this point in a very simple way. It goes like this. You see, for the hydrogen atom, I said this is minus 13.6 eV. Let's say we are trying to do this for the helium atom, this one. Now, for helium atom, what would happen is you'd go to the Schrodinger equation and use a potential that instead of having z equals 1, would have z equals 2. It'll be a little more negative. And actually, if you solve it, what you'd find is that the energy would be 4 times bigger. It goes as z square. Now, this is something that comes out of that simple Bohr model also. You know, the Bohr model argument, which I think in the book also I have it in the first couple of pages, that the Bohr model argument tells you it will be z square. And if you actually solve the Schrodinger equation numerically, you'd find that if you put z equals 2, this lowest level would all actually increase by a factor of 4. So what that means is instead of 13.6, what you'd get is something 4 times that, right? Which would amount to like 53.4 electron volts. So that's what you'd get if you just solve the Schrodinger equation for the helium atom using two protons. So what this says then is, if this is correct, that if you take a helium atom and you try to knock one electron out of the helium atom, you should require a photon whose energy is 53.4 volts. Okay? Experimental fact is that from a helium atom, the first electron when you knock it out, it takes about 25 volts, not 53 volts. So in other words, the real level is not here, but somewhere up, higher up. So what have we missed? Well, what we have missed is, of course, that because you have two electrons, we have missed the repulsive potential due to the other electron in a way. Because when there's two electrons and I'm trying to pull this one out, this one makes it a little easier to push him out, basically. Because this one's, you know, it's repelling it, doesn't really want it there, in a way. So it's pushing it out. So I don't really need 53 volts. Just 25 volts is good enough. Now, Schrodinger equation-wise, what it means is that it's not enough to have just a nuclear potential in this story. You add something else, which is due to the electrons. And this is the potential due to all the other electrons, while this is the potential due to the nucleus only. And this one is negative, because the nucleus is trying to hold it all in as tightly as possible. It pulls it all in. That's negative. This is all the other electrons which are really trying to get rid of each other. And so this one is positive. And it tends to raise all the energies. And so the bottom line is that whenever you are trying to calculate energy levels, you kind of need to include this additional potential due to all the other electrons. And what makes it hard, this one, and that's why this problem gets considerably more complicated and you actually need a computer for it, is that this one you can write immediately. You got a nucleus is a point source. You know, it's like a point charge. Its potential goes 1 over r, no problem. This one, this the other electrons, that's not a point charge at all. It's like, you know, you've got this positive nucleus here, it's like distributed all over. All the other electrons, you know, all the electrons are distributed. It's not a point charge. You can't write it as 1 over r. It's a sum of lots of them. How is it distributed? Well, the theory is that that wave function tells you how it's distributed. You see, in the sense that if the wave function for the 1s atom, let's say there's a plus new point here, where the wave function, say, looks like this, it'll usually look like e to the power minus r over the Bohr radius, something like that. The square of that gives you, tells you how the charge is actually distributed. Okay, but then I don't know how it is distributed till I've solved the Schrodinger equation. Because I have to get the phi, then I can square it, then I'll know what the how it's distributed, and then I'll know what to put in there. You see, so that's why it becomes an iterative process, kind of like that self-consistent calculation you have to do for, I think, the homework too. But more complicated version of it. So what this means is, you start with some guess, calculate phi, then put in all, fill up those states, find out exactly what the charge looks like, find its potential, see if it matched what you had guessed, and if it doesn't, you know, keep iterating till it converges. This is exactly what needs to be done to solve for any atom other than the hydrogen atom. Hydrogen atom is where you don't need it. Okay? And this kind of thing, actually, people did back in the 50s, by about 1960 or so. And in those days, as I said, computers were primitive. But still, it was good enough they could do calculations like this. And there's a book by John Slater, which describes all this very well, actually, this quantum theory of the atoms. And as I said, in this textbook, I think there is a picture that shows how well all the calculated energies match with what's experimentally observed. You know, so where there was, as I said, only the hydrogen atom one is the exact one. Everything else you are using some approximate potential here. Approximate in the sense that this way of thinking, of putting in an average potential, that itself is actually an approximate way of doing things. But based on that, they could match all these observed data very well. So it shows that you're more or less capturing the basics well. Okay. Now, one important concept here to remember is this concept of valence electrons. Now, what that means is that, you see, when you are looking at this first row of your periodic table, with hydrogen or helium, then you got the electrons down here. Those are all. Okay, now, once you get to the next level, next row, the outermost electrons are somewhere here. Now, why do I say outermost? Well, that's because, you see, as you go higher, the electron radius, I said that if you have a positive nucleus here, the electron is spread out here. Now, when you look at the electrons in one of these lower levels, it is actually spread out much less, in the sense that it is right around here, let's say. So the wave function looks like e to the power minus r over a zero, roughly, and that's what it looks like. So r over a n, let me put. So, where for the nth, when you go higher, the nth level has a radius that's bigger than the Bohr radius by this factor of n squared. So when you go to a higher one, it is actually spread out a lot more. So the one down here is very tightly tied to the nucleus. The one here is a little bit more spread out. And the one above it is always a little more, bit more spread out. And this is kind of important because, you see, when elements interact to form compounds, like all of chemistry, is because elements interact, they exchange electrons and so on. Or when we are trying to make devices where you actually have to put in an electron and take one electron out, all the action is actually at the highest level. Those are the electrons which are relatively more spread out. So when you put it on an electrode, you can take them out and put one in. Whereas the ones down here, those are very well tied to the nucleus, and you usually they don't know about what's going on outside, essentially. They're almost like they're part of the nucleus. So you call these the core electrons, and call these the valence electrons. You see? And so the valence electrons are basically the ones at the highest level on this. So what I mean is, if you are dealing with hydrogen or helium, then of course there is no core electron. It's all the same. It's just 1s level. That's just those two. But once you get to the next level or the next one, let's say silicon. Silicon is somewhere here. Its atomic number is 14. So if you go to silicon, it means 1s is full, 2s, 2p are full. 3s, 3p is where all the action is. That's like the outside, that's the outermost set. And this is what you'd call the valence electrons then. Okay? Because those are the electrons that are most spread out. And when you apply a voltage to it, those are the ones that are actually carrying the current. And when there's some chemical reaction going on, those are the electrons that are getting exchanged. This is a point we'll get a little clearer when we talk about this, that correctly speaking, you should be solving a two-electron problem, let's say for helium. Instead, what we are doing is we are solving a one-electron problem, saying that this electron feels some average potential due to that electron. Now, as long as you accept that, and most of the theories that you see of band structure, of solid-state physics, chemistry, everything that we're doing is based on that picture. The idea that that one electron feels some average potential due to the other electrons.
We take it as a many-body problem.
You're saying that you're approximating the real problem, with one where you're saying that one electron feels some average potential due to the other ones, and that's this one. And then all the discussion is about how to find that average potential. But that is already an approximation, and there are all kinds of approximations people use and argue about. So lots of papers are, they say, well, I found a better way of writing this potential, which gives you results that match experiment a whole lot better. Usually that would be the kind of arguments you'd have, you know, people who do research on these things. Okay. Whereas the correct problem, if you are solving it, would have been one where you'd be solving the Schrodinger equation for two electrons. So then you'd actually have a wave function, which instead of being phi of r, would be phi of r1 comma r2, where r1 would be the location of electron 1 and r2 is the location of electron 2. And that you can see why people don't do, because one of the points I made last day is how this problem of dimensionality. That, you know, 1D, 2D, 3D, how problems get harder. Now, if you're going, so this was like a 3D problem, which we try manage to simplify because of the angular symmetry. But the point is that when you are doing this hydrogen atom, originally it was a 3D problem. If you are going to put R1, R2, it becomes a 6D problem. And the thing is, the problem gets harder and harder exponentially, which is why you really don't want to solve the 14 electron problem in silicon. Right? Yeah.
Using the first approach, shouldn't we accept to have two wave functions at the end of the day, since we have to describe the distribution of two electrons? And since we take only one at the end, is that we have a problem to distinguish the electrons?
No. The way you do it then is, the picture people have is that with two electrons, it is as if one electron has this as a, has one wave function, and the other electron has another wave function. And then you just say the first one has a wave function of phi 1 r because it is in, say, 1s state. And let's say another one is in a 2s state and has a wave function of phi 2 r. And then you'd write the electron density as phi 1 r square plus phi 2 r square. Would add the electron. So overall, if I want to know how the electron density is distributed for the two electrons, it would be this square plus this square. Now, what you might, the very important subtle point here is, why didn't I do phi 1 plus phi 2 square, for example? This would be wrong. This is wrong. This is it. Right? So the way people do this is, they actually solve the one electron equation, find the possible levels, and then say, okay, I've got two electrons, I got, say, one here and one here, then the electron density is this square plus that square.
Yes, but in this case, you assume that you have different eigenvalues for the two electrons.
So you have different?
Said that the second electron would be at 2s state. But how can we distinguish the two wave functions where both electrons are at the s state? That's my question.
Well, in the S state also, if both are here, yeah, conceptually you still have actually two levels like this, right? So the correct way of including the spin is to actually say that it is, you know, just as with light, if you had two polarizations, you'd say one of them is polarized this way, one of them is polarized this way. Electrons also same. It's one S, this is one polarization, that's another polarization. The up and down are like two polarizations, let's say.
So we can't distinguish them.
Right. We actually haven't talked about how you mathematically write the wave function for an up spin and a down spin. We have kind of said in English what we are doing, but mathematically how you write it, what happens is actually it becomes a column vector. So what that means is up spin looks something like this, and a down spin would look something like this. That's basically it. But that would be the mathematical representation of an upspin electron and a downspin electron. So instead of having one number, it would become like a column vector with two functions in it. Okay? But that we don't need to get into yet. Later on we'll talk. At this stage, it's just like, yeah, there are two of them, you're adding it up. Okay? So this is this very important concept of the these valence electrons, namely that it's only the outermost ones that matter. And usually when you look at the energies, again, if you look in the book on this picture that's on, I guess it's on page 63, they have all these levels going down. Now, as far as the valence electrons are concerned, the outermost shell, their energies would usually be between 0 and minus 20 volts or so. Whereas if you look at the core electrons, those energies can be very large, you know, like large meaning large negative numbers, you know, like negative kilo electron volts. So to knock out a core electron, you'd really need very hard, you know, very high photons with H nu, enormous H nus. You see, kilovolt type H nus. Whereas to look at the valence electrons, you need H nu of 10, 20 volts. It's still beyond the visible, but it's 10, you know, visible light is like 1 or 2 volts. This would be 10, 20 volts or so. But all the valence electrons are about the same place, actually. And although from this formula, you would have thought that by the time it put Z equals, say, 14, like silicon, that energy would be very large, which is kind of true for the core electrons, but for the valence electrons, it's really doesn't. It is really shielded by all the negative charge in there. So you see, when you have 14 electrons and you're talking about the outermost electron, it really does not see the 14 positive charges because there's all these intervening core electrons in between. So it really sees something whose effective positive charge is not 14, much less, maybe more like 4 or 3. Because of all the core electrons surrounding it, etc. Now, which is why when discussing current flow later on, people don't even talk about the core electrons. We just talk about when you draw energy levels, you know, when you talk about conduction band and valence band and all that, you're really talking about the valence electrons. But these are very real, actually, and they have, you know, in many contexts, these are very useful, actually. So, for example, if you're trying for diagnostic purposes, these core levels are extremely useful. Why is that? Well, you see, if you had, say, solid silicon, and in here somewhere you have some impurity, and you're trying to figure out if there's an impurity there or not. You know, say aluminum or some other impurity. Now, the thing is, for aluminum as an element, people know what all these levels are. Now, once you put it inside a solid, the valence electrons, their energies will all change considerably. Why? Because their wave functions are all spread out around here, and they notice the fact that it's not in isolation anymore. It's inside a silicon matrix. It sees all the surroundings. And so the level kind of changes. The effective wave function has to take into account the potential due to the new surroundings, in a way. On the other hand, the core electrons, they sit right next to the nucleus. They don't even know that you're in the silicon matrix. As far as they're concerned, you're just sitting in here. You know, the fact that the environment has changed, they don't even notice. So the core electron is almost a property of that element, irrespective of what environment you put it in. So the way you can find out if you have aluminum in there or not is by doing core electron spectroscopy. Namely, let's say these are core electrons, so you find out what H nu it needs to knock these out. And then if you see it at an energy that matches aluminum, you immediately know you got aluminum in there. Because that, so for diagnostic purposes, the core electrons are very useful. And the valence electrons are useless because their energies will change depending on what environment they happen to be in. It's really no good as far as that is concerned. But in this class, of course, since we are talking about current flow, most of the rest of the course, you'll not even hear about the core electrons. We'll just generally be talking about the valence electrons. That's the issue. But they are very real, very useful in many different contexts. And depending on what course you are taking, you might hear a lot about them also. Now, the point that I want to continue on next day, and I just want to introduce it a little bit today, is this very important concept in many small devices. As I had mentioned before, that these days people can measure the conductance of things that are really small. And the smallest I know of is like the hydrogen molecule. But let's think of what you'd measure if you, let's say, actually looked at a hydrogen atom. Now, to my knowledge, that actually hasn't been done, right? But hydrogen atom is like the simplest thing. So you got these two 1s levels, you see, and you got one electron in there usually. So usually you think, let's say I've put it between two contacts, and I, let's say, have a chemical potential that's mu 1. That's mu 1. And let's say I've put a chemical potential high up here, that's mu 2. And the question is, what current would I get? So let's say we started here, and we're gradually pulling this up. And for this discussion, I won't worry about how these are moving or things like that. Let's assume this is fixed, and we're just moving it across it. Okay. So you might think then that, yeah, if you're here and you just gradually raise it, you might have thought, so the current should just step up. Now, actually, of course, as you know, you have to worry about the charging energy. Because once current starts flowing, so ordinarily you had one electron in there. But when current is flowing through this, the number of electrons is a little bit different. And so you'd think it may want to float up somewhat, etc. But the thing is, what would actually happen in something that small is that the current you'd get through this would be effectively as if you had only one level and not two. So in other words, instead of seeing, say, something like this that you might have thought, of course, because of charging, you might have thought it would get dragged out like this. But instead of this, what would really happen is you'd see a step here and then a second step there. So there'll be two steps. And actually, if you did this with a small hydrogen atom, you'd probably never even get to the second step, because this energy would be very large. It would take an enormous voltage to get there. And by the time you get there, you'd also be messed up with all the 2s, 2p other levels that would come into the picture. So in practice, with hydrogen atoms, you may not quite see this, though. But in principle, if you had a system with just two levels, the thing is, what happens is that you see two separate steps, one by one, rather than going through them together, even though they have exactly the same energy. Now, the way you understand this is something like this. It goes that, you see, let's say we start from a situation with the mu down here, so there are no electrons in here at all, let's say. You got this thing where it is. But then you're gradually filling it up. Now, when an electron comes in here, then because you have one electron present, this other level kind of will float up. That was the idea. Or, in this context, you know, the hydrogen atom, let's say you had an electron here already, and because you have pulled this down, you have pulled it out, and suddenly this has become positive, and that would again change all the levels immediately. So the point is that because the level moves up by an enormous amount, so let's think of it like it was empty and I've suddenly filled it up, and so this 1s level, this other one kind of floats up over there. And so it is way outside anything. Why is it up there? Well, because this got filled up, let's say. Now, the point I'm trying to make is that if this floats up, you might say, why didn't this one float up? You know, you think that whatever happens, they should float up together. Because after all, the way we discussed all this, and this I'll be discussing properly on Monday, if you have a potential U inside here, then all levels should float up accordingly. That is our usual thinking. So what that means is the entire density of states floats up, as you know. So that level and that level, they should all be up here. Now, why is it that only one floats up and not the other? Now, that is where there's this very important issue, and that is what's called self-interaction. That is, that no electron feels anything due to itself. It only feels a potential due to everyone else. So when you put an electron in there, in that level, that level feels that potential and would float up. But this one wouldn't because it doesn't feel anything due to itself. And on the other hand, this one is empty because it's way up there. And so it doesn't feel anything at all and it stays right there. You see? This is the important thing. And this is the thing that is very hard to get into all these theories. You see, these theories where you say that one electron feels some effective potential due to the other ones. The thing is, that electron feels something due to all the other ones except itself. And so you have to now keep track of what it means except itself. You know, you got 100 electrons, so everyone feels something due to the other 99. Okay. Now, in big conductors, usually this is no issue. Why? Because, you know, you got a million electrons in there, million minus one or a plus one, what does it matter? And each one, you know, you have this equation I had written down, U0 times N minus N0. So in big things, that number is like a million. This number is like, say, a 1 microvolt maybe. And together, maybe it will be about a volt. So overall, the effect is important. But it doesn't matter too much whether you add one or subtract one. That's not such a big issue anymore. But when you get to small conductors, actually, just putting one electron in there changes the potential by, could change the potential by a volt. In fact, if you had a conductor as small as a hydrogen atom, then just putting one electron in there would change the potential by like 10 volts or so. Enormous amount for something as small as a hydrogen atom. On the other hand, we are constantly dealing with conductors that are not as small as a hydrogen atom, but that are, say, 100 angstroms, 500 angstroms. And on that scale, putting one electron in can change the potential by a millivolt or more. And then it can get significant. So what we are saying is this is a fairly big number. And this number here is, let's say, 2 or 3. So you might have, say, a millivolt here and two or three here. And then it matters whether it is 2 minus 1 or exactly 2. There's a difference between the two, you see. So in small things, this is what's called the single electron charging effect. And this is what I'll try to explain on Monday in more detail. Okay.